many people have sidelined, young people, we have been put more on the streets rather than in the decision-making table. And most of our projects have not been amplified to a place where they can actually show tangible impact. So then the Inuka project comes in to sort of bridge that gap and show that young people, given the resources, the skills, the mentorship, and a platform to act, they are actually capable leaders that can bring around and create precedents towards solutions that we already know we envision.
This is the Crossroad Voices of Justice, and this is the first podcast series brought to you by Climate Development Knowledge Network about how different BIPOC individuals are addressing the effect of climate change and taking a lead in the environmental justice movement. I am Juvenal Vitalis, and I am based in Tanzania. In this first episode of our podcast series, I had the pleasure of interviewing Bulimo, a passionate 26-year-old environmentalist working at the crucial intersection of nature, climate, and justice. Bulimo plays a pivotal role in the Inuka Project, an initiative dedicated to addressing the pressing challenges of climate change in his home country, Kenya. Throughout our conversation, we explored his journey into environmental activism and delve into the significant impact their projects are making within local communities. Furthermore, Inuka Distinctively, a youth-led and youth-focused restoration accelerator, is not just making strides in Kenya. It's a pilot with aspiration beyond its current scope, aiming to use the learnings from Kenya to bolster youth leadership in nature-based solutions and to expand the project reach across other African nations and the Global South.
What inspired you to take environmental science?
I think the story goes back to when I was a kid. My parents were very... at a very local level, they were very environmentally conscious. My father, to be precise, until today, you come to our home and it has the cleanest compound, because when he wakes up, that is the first thing he wants to do. He wants to ensure that his compound is very clean, and he'll just, after cleaning, he'll sit back and just admire the space. And I felt like this is something that really connects him to nature. Yet even the neighborhood, our neighbors would, you know, come and scold us that we, the young generation, we are very lazy. We let the older people do all the work. But to him, I think it was the way that he was connecting with nature. So ideally, taking cue from that, I also wanted something that would really connect me to nature and the ecosystem around me, but also impacting communities. And that's how my journey started.
Bulimo attended a hunger freedom campaign in sixth grade, which sparked his passion for community activism and justice.
Freedom from Hunger March was more about how the climate was changing and that we are going to have inadequate food supply. So it was just a call to the government to help prepare the masses and support them as they would be able to. And I think by engaging in that particular movement, I felt like as if I was part of something bigger than myself, and I was actually part of a solution. And I thought, then how can I better this and extend on this trajectory? And when I entered in high school, of course, I joined an environmental club. Then coming to campus, I was so sure I wanted to do environmental science. But beyond that, I must also mention the support that the circle around me accorded me. They already had a foresight of the space, unlike me, and so they were very instrumental in like mentoring and shaping me. And also coming out here, I met some very nice figures, including my immediate outgoing boss Kaluki, who like played a significant role in mentoring and nurturing me into, you know, joining into the space, understanding the one-on-ones of activism and how we can impact community, and learning leadership, believing in yourself, self-motivation, and also just working with other people around you to create greater impact. So
I love that you mentioned something about mentorship. And in one of my podcast episodes, we also talked the importance of mentorship. So how did it play the role in your work? work as an environmental expert?
So I have two perspectives to mentorship as of present, given like my over about 3 to 4 years experience now in the field active. My peers, fellow young people, they have been very instrumental. They, you know, they will always support you when you feel like you want to do something. They'll always come and urge and boost your morale to do that particular thing. When we have, for example, marches, they will call you and say, hey, there is this something happening over the weekend. Would you want to join? So I think young people among themselves are very encouraging and supportive of each other and the work that they're doing. But having implemented Inuka, the intergenerational gap and from the mentorship angle of it is still significantly lacking. I think we have not very well scored in terms of bridging the gap between those that can be before us and the generation that currently is and also the generation that is coming up. Because one of the critical components of Inuka is mentorship. Because what we are doing at Inuka is we are resource and capacity building young people to lead on their solutions. So we are providing, for example, training on IUCN Global Standard for nature-based solutions. But as you can know, the nature-based solution landscape as it is even currently, it's very murky and it's very vulnerable to greenwashing, co-options, false solutions, human rights, land rights, and all those things. But then even as young people want to engage meaningfully in that space, there is only so much that they know. But there are people who have been in this space long enough to understand how the terrain works, but it has proved a significant challenge to get a hold of them. So while we are implementing the project and on our own, we have been able to do so much, we feel like there is just so much more that we could be able to do. Should we be able to get a hold of these people that would have played the role of mentorship, which until now has not been possible, because every time you approach someone that you think is a potential mentor, they're always busy or they're always rescheduling you. And, you know, time is moving. Projects are usually time bound, as you know it. So we are almost 3/4 into the project and we have not been able to secure that particular mentorship to even see how we will sustain this knowledge hub beyond the initial time frame of the project. So again, just using this opportunity to urge the need to close that intergenerational mentorship gap, and that the people who came behind us to before us to like sort of hold our hands so that we can also be able to pass down that the generations that will come after us.
You mentioned intergenerational gap, right? And you said it's so difficult to like find mentor who are really invested into it. I mean, not just invested, but sometimes people are busy. If we can bridge the gap between this movement, how do you think we can bridge intergenerational gap in climate justice work?
So I think there are very many avenues that we can address that. And number one, it starts with the basics of building the mentor-mentee relations. I think the best avenues to get, for example, these mentors and mentees is to bridge that gap is, for example, in conferences. But the way these conferences are also designed is by themselves very exclusive of young people. You realize that we have things like Conference of Youth or the Youth Assembly, where young people just converge with themselves, and then after they are done, you know, there is nothing significant that they're coming to do into the main conference where actually the mentors are. So I think the first problem is a design problem. And I just wish that the way conferences, for example, are designed, they should be designed in such a manner that they're very youth friendly and they're not like separating the young people from the older generation, but rather having all these people like assembled in one room. And then number two, even as young people, as we are organizing our all talk shows and dialogues, let us be friendly about, you know, inviting the older people into our spaces and let them just know, understand what we are talking about, as opposed to meeting in cocoons, making deliberations, and then now wanting to take that final product to the other older people to like sort of look at it. We want to have them in our discussions from the stage of inception. And then another thing I think is just for the older persons themselves to understand that young people are not a liability, that we are assets, we are passionate, so we are leaders in this space. What we just need is to be held hands rightly through that particular path that we are trying to lead on.
How do you define climate justice?
I define climate justice as an initiative where everyone feels included, an initiative where we are providing conducive environment for everyone and everything to thrive, both at the present and in the future. So for instance, vulnerable communities can access water, vulnerable communities can access resources, but also the rich have their own mechanism with which they can get access to the very same thing that the people at the, for example, at the slums are getting. So I can use an example of people living in a slum that is adjacent to people living in a suburb or a wealthy neighborhood. So you realize that people from the wealthy neighborhood will have their trash come and thrown at a field adjacent to people living in the slum. That particular disparity that shows that the people who live in slums are the ones who are supposed to be near the dump site is now the injustice. But addressing that is identifying, for example, a very common ground that has undergone the environmental impact assessment that is neither close to the people in the slum nor close to the people in the wealthy neighborhood, and establishing it in such a way that we can safely all of us dispose our waste there. So that is a good example of how I can define climate justice. So that everyone is able to equally and equitably access to the scarce resources at our disposal.
And why do you think it's an important thing in the context of Kenya as a country and globally?
Climate justice is important because, number one, of the disparities and the cascading vulnerabilities factors that it poses, because one challenge would lead to the other. Because if, for example, people in the slums are exposed to toxic chemicals, are exposed to dirty water, are exposed to garbage, it creates this level of, for example, ill health. It creates this level of social and economic troubles. It creates this poverty index increases. It creates this difficulty in accessing, for example, medical education services. And then these people now start trying to make enmity with the adjacent wealthy neighbors who are able to get all these services in time. So climate justice comes in such a manner that it creates a system where everyone is able to be addressed in a decent, humane manner, so that they are not able to have a situation of us versus them, but more of a synergy where we can come together and share ideas on how to achieve a common goal that will not only benefit us who are utilizing the scarce resources at present, but also have cascading effects through the generations that are coming in the future. So I think for a country, it is then important that we establish policies that are not wealthy friendly and the poor unfriendly, but policies that are more holistic and inclusive of everyone within a particular ecosystem, so that benefits derived from that particular ecosystems can benefit the whole community like equally and equitably.
Going back to the work that you're doing with Youth for Nature,
okay,
what are some of the challenges that you faced?
Our challenges, as I have mentioned, are mainly, of course, financing. You know, young people have significantly been underfunded within the nature climate space. Nature and climate in itself is underfunded, but within that particular ecosystem, then young people are disproportionately underfunded in that whole discourse. And many people have sidelined young people. We have been put more on the streets rather than in the decision-making table. And most of our projects have not been amplified to a place where they can actually show tangible impact. So then the Inuka project comes in to sort of bridge that gap and show that young people, given the resources, the skills, the mentorship, and a platform to act, they are actually capable leaders that can bring around and create precedents towards solutions that we already know we envision. So finances has been a challenge. Even with the pilot itself, we did not get enough money to fully implement the pilot, but we said we will use whatever we have to start the journey and then see how it goes from there. So a critical component of the Inuka project is the micro-granting. And this micro-granting, we sort of want to ensure that funding for restoration and for climate actually reaches the grassroots where it is needed the most, because there is a lot of money that is flying around, but it's not going to the targeted audience. Most of the funds are used perhaps in just building policy discussions, but then the translation of this policy into tangible on the ground work has significantly lacked. So Inuka sort of tries to make a case that young people, given these resources, can actually do so much. And as a pilot and the amount of impact that we are making, we are looking at a situation where we can use that as a motivation to, you know, implore other many young people, given resources, to also take initiative for nature and for climate. And then another challenge that we also mentioned is about mentorship. Not very many mentors in the field are willing to take the risk of holding young people's hand. We have had a very significant risk burden bestowed upon young people, which then limits them from actually exploiting their full potential. So we also want to urge that young people are very ready, willing to partner with stakeholders from across board in an effort to realize our shared visions again, because nature and climate, as we all know, it's very cross-border and it's not a one-person solution problem. It requires synergies from across the divide. And you cannot literally make decisions for nature and climate for which young people are the one who are going to benefit or be impacted the most, because they are the people who will be there tomorrow when the persons who are making the decisions are no longer there. So we hope that we can really be included meaningfully into this discussion, so that then we co-lead in creations of these solutions rather than just being there to tick a diversity card, or more in a very tokenistic way that is not meaningful in itself. And then the third thing is we are operating in a nature-based solutions sort of terrain, which still remains to be very murky. I talked about the vulnerabilities within the nature-based solutions and restoration space, things to do with co-option, false solutions. There is this new conversation about carbon markets and the impact it has on community, land rights, and all that. And so we really need to have young people capacity build on how to navigate these particular issues, because then the failure of which risks them implementing what would actually not be right solutions, even though their intention is very clear.
Speaking of grassroots movements and grassroots voices, do you think that these people, especially youth, do they have enough spaces to voice out their concerns about climate?
I wouldn't want to be a doomsayer and say that all is null and void, but I'd say that there is still a very long way to go. We have the idea of what we want, but the platform, the right platform to channel our ideas, significantly lack. A few months ago, I was in New York for the New York Climate Week, and we had the Global People March, was attended by over 70,000 people. Majority of those people were young people. But I was also lucky to be in a certain room where they were talking about a pathway to net zero. And that room was full of people from the World Bank, people from the FAO, people from the Nature Conservancy, and all these big organizations. The people were actually influencing decisions. And unfortunately, I was just among the one of two young people that were there. And the other young person that was there was because he was working for one of those big organizations. Otherwise, I'm so sure they wouldn't be there. And so you look at these two and you want to imagine, is this by default or by design? Because yes, we can go to the streets, but how much are we going to influence policy from the street? There is just so much we can do along the streets. Yet in these closed rooms where actual decision making is happening, you'd rarely find young people. Look at the COP, for instance, that is going on right now. We have a few people who are there. Many young people still lack access to such spaces. But even taking a statistic of those who are there, many are there on an observer basis where there is nothing much. They cannot contribute to the significant discussions around decision-making and outcomes of COP. They're just there to, you know, to watch and learn. And the question is, until when? Because I think it is time that we also give young people a chance to be at the table and reason with policymakers. Or if you feel like they don't yet have the capacity, why then don't you create mechanisms where they can get this knowledge and capacity to be able to meaningfully engage in those spaces? So I think we have the idea, but either by design or by default, we continue to be put at the peripheries where our impact is like very much limited.
I wanted to touch something about Youth for Nature are doing. How does storytelling play a role in your work as an environmental activist?
So I think stories are a vehicle of hope. They are used to tell stories of the effort that, you know, people put into things. For example, if you come here and found a project has already been done, it is only through storytelling, in whichever form, whether infographic, video, audio, that you'll be able to understand the effort that was taken, number one, to achieve that particular result, and number two, an affirmation that it can actually be done using this and this particular criteria. And number three, I think stories are an impact vehicle that can use to exemplify the work that has been done on the ground. So for us, storytelling has been a critical component to elevate young people's voices, especially those that are working at the grassroots where otherwise their impact will never have reached. So we have the Glocal story map, which is a sort of a virtual story map that exemplifies and amplifies the stories of young people from across the world, the work that they are doing. If you have a project that you have implemented and you feel it's very impactful to your community, we have a campaign that we usually call on a regular basis, and you can submit your story with your name and the work that you've done, and we then upload it to the global storytelling map. Now, what that storytelling map does is multi-tier. Number one, it amplifies your story. Number two, it connects you to other people doing similar initiatives. So if you go through that story map, you can see maybe, for example, people doing restoration in this part of the world, people doing whichever kind of work in whichever part of the world, and you can easily be able to start a conversation with those people through that story map. And then number three, it is also an avenue for collaboration and partnerships between young people that are doing works on the ground with funders and potential people that can hold their hand to even increase the scale of their impact.
And how do we incorporate local communities' perspectives and needs in climate justice initiatives like INOCA?
So the first thing for us is usually, number one, community buy-in and community entry. You cannot go and implement a project in a particular community without the consent of the community. You need to be in unison with the community members about the project that you want to implement. That is number one. Number two, you don't bring community solution. You help, you facilitate communities in implementing their own solutions. So like in Uka, what we are doing, we are working with about 4 or 3 youth groups in like about 4 unique ecosystems. These youth groups are already implementing restoration projects in their respective ecosystem. What Inuka is just doing is, number one, to capacity build them on how to effectively implement their solutions so that they don't become vulnerable to greenwashings or false solutions or co-options, to ensure that land and community rights are well incorporated within their project, to ensure that their projects are having biodiversity net gain, they are contributing to socioeconomic development and things like that. They are having trade-offs, balanced trade-off between what the community is giving in and what the community is reaping out of those particular projects. So that is number one. Another thing is those communities where themselves, we need to have like some sort of engagement or entanglement, so that even as we progress in implementing the project, they can also have their say. In Marsabit, for example, where we are working with NAPO to implement farmer managed natural regeneration, that is a purely arid and semi-arid land. So we don't come there to say, you know what, you are pastoral communities, don't keep animals or don't do what. What we are just doing is we are, as the name suggests, farmer managed natural regeneration. The organization has partnered with the community to say, hey, this ecosystem is significantly degrading. Can we mark particular areas in this particular ecosystem so that when the pastoralists are passing their cows, they define a particular pathway that will not interfere with this system, so that the ecosystem with this particular area naturally regenerates. And then once they are regenerated, we can see how they sustainably use that even as we go and then mark another territory and then allow it to regenerate. So you can see that we are securing a place to allow it to regenerate while the rest of the places can be used to cater for their own livelihood gains. And also we are trying to, through community partnerships again, look at what are the alternatives that the communities can actually leverage. For example, ASALs are very good with fruits. Are there some fruit trees that pastoralists can leverage to grow or just multiply their production so that they can then sell and acquire a source of income that will reduce pressure on already degraded land? So it is more of a discussion, and there are ways that work, there are ways that don't work. But what we don't do is we don't impose ideas to communities. We allow communities to brainstorm ideas, and then we just come in to sort of facilitate and give the technical help on how that can be implemented. So that is how we bring communities into achieving climate justice.
Looking ahead, what are your aspirations for the environmental movements in Kenya and globally?
I think I'll again talk about the young people, and I think what our greatest setback from within ourselves has been compartmentalization of youth action. We, most of us, have almost the same ideas, but most of us don't want to work together. And I keep using this example. I was attending an adaptation forum in Sharm el-Sheikh last year during COP27. And the Africa Development Bank had this youth accelerator project that was trying to support young people, but they had set a ceiling to apply for their funds at $100,000. Unfortunately, many young people, their projects could not reach $100,000. So most of our projects were $5,000, $10,000, maybe at most $30,000. And then young people are complaining, why can't you reduce that ceiling down so that most of us can get this fund? But that guy challenged them and asked them, what do you do? It's restoration. What do you do? It's advocacy. What do you do? It's tree planting. This, don't you think this is just the same thing? why can't you guys come together, combine your ideas, and then apply this as one particular project with a more bigger impact? Because the truth is, if you go and apply something small, restoration, if you are a student of restoration, you'll understand that restoration occurs best at a landscape level. So if you want to do a project of planting 50 trees, when you have been given an opportunity to partner with someone and, you know, grow maybe 10,000 or 100,000 trees, I bet you'd want to partner to increase that impact, because then that is how you realize the gains, the biodiversity and all the ecosystem gains from that particular project that you're doing, as opposed to wanting to do a project that will just grow about 50 or 100 trees. So, but you know, many young people would not want to do that because of governance challenges, which is also another issue, because everyone wants to find out, like, who will control the money, who will be the boss. We are more intrigued around the literal leadership of an entity than we are intrigued about the impact that that particular entity will provide. So again, just to challenge young people to think beyond money and come together to sort of increase the impact of the work that they are doing. So we need to stop compartmentalization of our work and just synergize for meaningful change. And then number two, we need unlocking of finances, of course. Not just unlocking, but ensuring that these finances trickle down to the intended purpose. Then number three, we need to learn governance, accountability, and transparency, so that even as we claim that we need resources to support our work, but should we be given those resources, then are we able to utilize these resources in a sustainable manner that will yield optimal gains for the work that we are doing? That is also a particular question which most young people have also not been able to score at that particular card very well. So we need to learn some sort of accountability safeguards, transparency safeguards, but also general governance, so that when we are trusted with the resources, we can actually portray that these resources will do that which was intended to do and report effectively on the same.
Reflecting on your journey so far, what are you most proud of in the climate justice movement?
What I'm most proud of is, first of all, at a personal level, I think with support from other young people, we have actually been able to use our voices to drive change. I can give you an example that I used to volunteer in an organization that, okay, first of all, we have driven change in such a manner. For example, we have changed meaningful youth engagement,
yeah,
and the concept of volunteership as it were, and as it continues to evolve, I can confidently say that through our voices, we are really changing and we are seeing it bear fruits. I was part of an organization that really, really just, I don't know whether it was subconsciously or by design, but it just likes to use young people as tool to achieve their goals in the name of volunteership. But because of our sustained push to change that, because we could ask ourselves question, how comes an organization can spend almost 100 or 10,000 USD booking a venue to hold a campaign, but the young people that have invested their emotional, physical, visible and invisible labor to make that activity happen, they can't even be given anything to incentivize their work? And we kept asking this question, and I'm happy to learn to report that currently, as I am speaking, almost 5 to 7 of the people that I know that we used to push for this particular reform, including others that were not even part of that movement, have now been employed with that particular organization. But that was not the case then. You guys will do all this work, but when there is a vacancy in the organization outsources someone. And you see, that is how you breed resentment, because that affects someone, because people work so hard hoping they will be realized, recognized at the end. But when an opportunity comes, you want to give to an outsider, yet there's someone here who has proved that they are worth it just because they are young people. you deny them the opportunity. So I think that is number one. Then number two is more aligned towards Youth for Nature. I think Youth for Nature has revolutionized the concept of meaningful youth engagement. Youth for Nature recognizes that there is a lot of emotional, visible and invisible labor that goes into the work that young people are doing. And it is working to bridge the systemic barriers that is preventing young people to realize the goals that they are pursuing. And so Youth for Nature, for example, to its volunteers, it will provide things like laptops, it will provide internet support, very basic things according to its ability, but that are very critical in ensuring that young people are able to lead on the solutions. Youth for Nature, once if they want to employ you, they'll not pay you as a young person, they will pay you as a professional to do that job that you're going to do. And they believe that you need at least to start from somewhere to be able to climb. And so I think that is something that all other organizations should emulate. Let us not be extractive. Let us not exploit young people in the name of volunteership. Let young people see value in the work that they're doing, even as they continue to support a drive towards sustainable future.
And the last question is, can you share your thoughts on how individual can contribute to a more sustainable and just future?
It starts from something as simple as behavior change. Just something as simple as throwing that particular trash in a dustbin, to questioning your leaders on the policies that they are putting to ensure a sustainable future, to using your active citizen duty to voting in people that are mindful of a sustainable future, to encouraging colleagues to live in a sustainable manner, not to be wasteful. I think it starts from that very basic level to going now to spreading the gospel using the platforms that you have so that more people can join in, because they say the greatest challenge bigger than the climate crisis is the inability to act. And that inability to act stems from the fact that people think the crisis is too big, that their action is basically negligible, that it cannot do anything. The crisis is too big, it's beyond us. So that's sort of encouraging people that you don't need to do everything. Just do what you are able within your reach, and the next person will do their bit, and collectively, then we are able to do something that is impactful.
The conversation with Bulimo Peter was really, really necessary. I've learned a lot of things that I either didn't know or knew, but neglected due to our inability to focus on them, and sometimes ignoring them because we think are small to make a change in our day-to-day action. We discussed the issue of intergenerational mentorship gap and how it hinders progress toward achieving climate justice. We also talked about how this gap affects efforts to engage youth in environmental movements, especially in the Global South. Furthermore, we delve into the distribution of funding within the climate sector and stress the importance of directing this fund to grassroots levels. This is crucial to ensure that resources are directed where they are most needed and can have the greatest impact. But frankly, it's clear that substantial efforts are required to turn the tables and to tackle these pressing issues and challenges. But for now, I urge you to listen, learn, and act now, because the world needs all of us, even if it just means saying a word. You have been listening to the Crossroad Voices of Justice, a podcast series on climate justice brought to you by CDKN. I am Juvenile Vitalis. That's the end of our show. Check out the show notes for more about Bulimo Peter and the Youth for Nature Inuka project. And to find out more about the series, please follow us on Instagram at the Unapologetic Human Pod. And for more information about CDKN, visit cdkn.org. I would like to extend special thanks to the team at the Global Landscape Forum and everyone who contributed to making this podcast series possible. This work was carried out with the aid of a grant from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Netherlands and the International Development Research Center, IDRC, Canada.